Well, as you can see on the back of your bulletin, the scripture reading for today is rather lengthy, but it's one of those things that sometimes in the Old Testament, the story goes a little while in order to get all the story. It is a lengthy reading, and so I'll just jump right on into it. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams about them, and he said to them, "You're spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you. You are spies. And this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. They said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come on us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then came back and spoke to them. They didn't realize Joseph was actually loving them right then. And this message is about love. So what is love? Well, a very simple, basic answer. You might say that love is one of our intense emotions, a deep affection for or a serious and strong attachment to a person or a group of people such as family or a group of people such as this church. And of course, we often use the word love to express our attachment to things, to a pet or a car or an experience like, I love that trip. But I want to keep it for this time of thought to an emotion between people. And of course, between God and His created people. Such love is, in a large sense, a means to delight in, to take pleasure in, to share experience with people or a person. I'm old enough to be reminded of that popular song of the mid-1900s that declares, "Love makes the world go round." And another about that same time that insisted that what the world needs now is love. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing or try to sing either one of those right now. But don't we need to resurrect and sing those sentiments to today's world? We unfortunately, but blatantly, honestly, are living in a world that is far more characterized by jealousies and greed and more just evil, hate, hate flashing across our television screens with almost every broadcast of the nightly news. Okay, maybe I do need to sing it again. Don't worry, I won't. But what the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's not enough of. You remember that? So let's talk about love. One kind of love that is too bad, so unfortunately alien to us as natural man, is love that describes the essence of God's character. That kind of love is different enough that the Greek language had a separate word for it, not to be confused with the more simple loves of just affection or of sexual attraction. Now, the Greeks had separate words for those kinds of love, phileo and eros. But the Greek language specifically delineates God-like love by the word that you've heard in church many times, agape, a pure and self-sacrificing, unconditional love. Well, actually, that's right. Some of you remember that just 2 weeks ago. As a matter of fact, in last Sunday morning sermon that I preached 2 weeks ago, I explained again that word agape, describing it as a separate love word, describing God's love. And it is agape love that enables a true Christian, a sincere follower devoted to Christ, to love the unlovable, to really love those who are making themselves hard to love. And the truth is, all of us periodically encounter those who fit themselves into this unenviable catalog, making themselves hard to love. But again, going back just 2 weeks, didn't we learn again that when Jesus said the second commandment was like the first one, what he said was the first commandment was love God completely. Second command, love your neighbor. And it's the same as the first. Jesus also gave us, as God's people, a complete definition of neighbor. Anyone other than yourself, including those who make themselves unlovable, our enemies. So very simply, but profoundly, as children of God, we are compelled to follow after the example of God and love the unlovable. Our scripture text precedes by almost 2,000 years this great teaching of Jesus about loving everyone, even those who try to make themselves unlovable. Yet that is precisely one of the major themes of the life of Jacob, or Joseph, the son of Jacob. This great biblical character, Joseph, lived out a life as an example of one who demonstrated the ability to love those who were hard to love. Now, conflict is a relationship killer. And the seeds of conflict between Joseph and his brother were sown early in his life. Joseph was born the first son of Jacob and the true love of his life, Rachel. All of the other sons of Jacob, except Benjamin, were sons of substitute and competing wives because Rachel could not have children for a long time. When she could, the two final sons to Jacob, and now Jacob and Rachel, were Joseph and Benjamin, with Rachel dying while giving birth to Benjamin. Thus, all Jacob had for memories with his favorite wife were those two boys. And Joseph became very obviously his favorite son. During the time after the death of his mother, Joseph seems to have become the errand boy of the family. He's taking messages back and forth between Jacob and the older sons that were out working in the fields. And I think it would be natural to assume that the favorite son status enjoyed by Joseph must have had a negative effect on the 10 older brothers. Special emphasis is given in Genesis to the colorful coat that Jacob had presented to Joseph. And that negativity jumps out at you when Joseph made what would be his last visit to the brothers to check up on them for his father. But we see that negativity already present sometime earlier when Joseph had made one of his go see how they're doing trips. And he brought back a bad report on the brothers. And I'm sure they really loved him for that. Genesis 37:2 recorded that incident as he was out with the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. That's what Genesis tells us. Joseph was a tattletale. And that surely incurred the contempt of his brothers. The bad situation became intensified when Jacob showed partiality to Joseph by giving him this famous coat of many colors. Verse 4 of that same chapter says, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, and they were seeing that with the presentation of this coat, it says they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. To make matters worse, the next verse tells us Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. The gist of that dream was that he saw himself standing high above his brothers, even standing above his father, and all of them bowing down to him. This, of course, served only to ignite the already burning flames of hostility among the brothers, who were all having this one person make life miserable for them, even though apparently Joseph wasn't necessarily trying to be their enemy. While not doing anything to try to make light of the favoritism, they didn't know how to handle it. He wasn't doing anything. Then he had another dream. Same idea, same result. When he reported it to his brothers and his father, growing hostility. He, Joseph, was antagonizing and becoming the enemy. And that's the second side to this picture that we really almost never consider. What did Joseph do wrong? And do I ever appear to be an enemy to someone just because I'm not paying attention to the character I'm portraying? Did Joseph have some faults here? I think so. Of course, the one thing he couldn't help was that his mother was Rachel, Jacob's very obviously favorite wife. But, you know, could Joseph have played that down? I don't know that he didn't, but we don't have any evidence that he took occasion to assure his brothers that he didn't want to be special. Could he have avoided giving his father a bad report that time that he did? Or even asked his brothers to try to understand why he had to? We don't know, but he probably should have paid attention that by doing that, he had angered his brothers. Did he need to flaunt the privilege of a coat of many colors? We don't know that he flaunted it, but he made it apparent enough often enough to make it an issue with his brothers. Why could he only wear it? Why couldn't he only wear it when his brothers were away in the fields, if he had any sensitivity to the fact that it was bothering them? And why in the world would he choose to wear it when he went out to the fields that last time to find his brothers? He couldn't have help having the dreams that God was speaking to him, but did God include the instructions to go interpret these dreams to your family and tell them how you will eventually rule over them? He wanted Joseph to know that, but he didn't want the rest of them to know it. Well, of course, that's a possibility, but the fact is that kind of behavior will indeed make you appear to be the enemy of someone. Thus, I believe one other lesson we need to draw from the life and times of Joseph is I need to always take care as to how I and my actions appear to people surrounding my life. I can make myself an enemy only, the kind of an enemy that only Christians have the love of God will reach out to love me. And that brings us to this. The hatred in the heart of Joseph's brothers erupted, overwhelming Joseph and changing the course of his life. Suddenly, Joseph, who had enjoyed privilege and power in the family, found himself being jostled along to Egypt to be sold by the Midianites. We're not told this, but since Joseph hadn't been very thoughtful about the effects of his life up to now, it's quite possible that this man of God may have begun to develop his own deep hatred, a hatred for his brothers. What had they done to him? We can imagine the total frustration of this very sheltered young man, stripped by his brothers from all the privileges of loving protection of his father's domain, and plunked down now as a slave in an alien land. And things went from bad to worse. First, he was victimized by a cunning and seductive woman. Then he was imprisoned on a false charge, and his life hung in the balance. But Joseph's belief that God was speaking specifically to him as an agent of future truths through his dreams, or perhaps visions, gave him a purpose, kept him true. And the harsh discipline of his trials, from his sale as a slave by his brothers to the temptation and false accusations resulting in his imprisonment, all combined to temper his life for the unique role that God had prepared for him. I believe maturity came quickly to young Joseph. In the Egyptian prison, he prayed often, and he moved his outlook to one of humble service rather than a privileged child. He proved himself to the jailer, and he was soon put in charge of the other prisoners. Finally, Joseph found himself before the ruling Pharaoh, having been called there to interpret two dreams the king had dreamed. Knowing the guidance God had already given to him through dreams over and over, this time Joseph humbly said, "I cannot do it, but God will give the Pharaoh the answer he desires." That's Genesis 41. And what we see as we look for it flowing from Genesis 37 to chapter 41 is the growing awareness by Joseph that God's blessing of redemption in his life was that God's leadership was God's love given freely to one who had probably been best seen described as a teenager with nothing more than being a spoiled brat. I think this is what Joseph knew. I'm speaking as Joseph. I lived a privileged life. I flaunted it with my brothers to get under their skin. God had a greater purpose for my life and was trying to get through to me through vivid dreams I was spoiled enough to exploit. Through evil, I was taken down many notches to be just a slave. I began to follow God's lead and became a trusted servant. Evil stepped in again and I was tested by prison life, but I trusted God, the God I had come to know. I got a new chance by the gift of God was giving me and showing me the interpretation of dreams. And I gave God the credit now for visionary dreams of others. And God, in His gracious love, placed me through all of his steps into a position where through loving forgiveness of the evil of my brothers, my enemies, I was able to facilitate the salvation of my whole family and begin the establishment of a whole nation of people as God's chosen people. I believe Joseph went through all of that. The truth is, we must all gather from this amazing multi-decade story that it was Joseph being brought to an understanding that it was not as a privileged person that he would thrive. Rather, it was being brought to his knees in submission that opened the way for God's love to flow through him to his brothers in their crisis, and thus to the nation of Israel. through all of the experiences I just named, God was preparing Joseph for something special. He was destined to be a unique wheel, a special instrument in the assembly of God's sovereign plan of developing his chosen people, Israel. And the climactic moment of the power of love came when Joseph's brothers stood there before him, although they, of course, didn't recognize him, to appeal for just food for the family's survival in famine-stricken Canaan. This was Joseph's moment for vengeance. 21 years had passed since they had sold him into slavery, and now was the time to get even. But that wasn't what was in Joseph's heart. His heart was touched even more as he overheard their expressions of remorse for their act of selling him off to slavery. And he was deeply touched by Reuben's declaration that they deserved what he thought they were about to get from this Egyptian ruler. When he looked at them and he heard their contrition, verse 24, he turned away from them and began to weep. And we learn that his weeping was tears of joy, tears of love for those who at one time had considered him their own brother as enemy. The story of Joseph's loving, forgiving treatment of his brothers is one of the greatest stories in all of literature. It's a story of love overcoming hatred and vengeance. Yet in this thing that was happening in Joseph's life, it was only after a long chain of events, during which time Joseph learned love by the way God had proved his love for Joseph. Loving those who are hard to love is truly one of the most difficult experiences any of us face in life. And I believe that sometime in our lives, almost all of us, if not all of us, find it exceedingly difficult to love those who have dealt viciously or treacherously with us. Yet God will teach us to love all people if we'll allow ourselves to become teachable students of Christ, as was evidenced vividly in Joseph's learning from God. And perhaps a really good place, maybe a best place to begin and then continue, is for us to memorize, to remember, to live by words of instruction on the ultimate example of giving of God's love. Paul said it so well to the church at Rome, Romans 5:8. God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Now, one more word. Forgiveness is an essential for love to be found and to get started with any adversary. So, I invite you to come back next Sunday as I'll try to lead you through the instructions of Jesus on how to forgive. Come back if you will.